headlines, Iran rejects a joint statement by the U.S. and GCC members, saying it is in line with Washington's strategy to sow division among regional countries. Syria's president says sabotage by terrorist groups and sanctions are complicating the country's situation following last week's deadly earthquake. And China imposes sanctions on two American companies for selling arms to Taiwan amid rising tensions over the shootdown of an alleged Chinese spy balloon. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran has rejected a joint statement by the U.S. and member states of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council. Tehran says the statement is in line with American regime's long-standing strategy to foam a division among regional countries. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says the U.S.'s destructive and interventionist policies are behind the existing crises in West Asia and the Persian Gulf. He noted that Iran believes in regional diplomacy and maintains that the ongoing crises must be resolved through political solutions. Kanani added that U.S. supports Takfiri terrorism and Israel's crimes against Palestinians and is responsible for the devastating war in Yemen. He hoped that regional countries would work to promote peace, security, and sustainable development in the region through a good understanding of Washington's evil policies. Undercover reporters have exposed an Israeli group that is said to have manipulated over 30 elections around the world through hacking, sabotage, and disinformation. The group, which uses a code name Team George, was exposed by undercover footage and documents leaked to The Guardian newspaper. The group is run by a former Israeli Special Force member, Tal Hanan, that had been working for more than two decades providing service to intelligence agencies, political campaigns, and private companies. The group said it had been involved in 33 presidential elections around the world, such as Nigeria's race in 2015. One of its methods to manipulate public opinion is by controlling thousands of fake social media profiles on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, Telegram, Gmail, Instagram, and YouTube. In recent years, Israel has been the main exporter of cyber weaponry, undermining democracy and human rights. The United Nations Security Council has circulated a draft resolution demanding Israel cease its settlement activities in the occupied Palestinian territories. The resolution, which calls for immediate and complete cessation of Israel's settlement activities, was circulated ahead of a meeting on the situation in Palestine. The draft resolution reaffirms that the establishment of Israeli settlements has no legal validity and is a flagrant violation of international law. The Security Council is scheduled to meet on Monday to discuss the situation in Palestine. The new development followed a decision by Israel on Sunday to legalize 9 settlement outposts in the occupied West Bank. The U.S. has already rejected the draft, describing it as unhelpful without explicitly threatening a veto. And Hezbollah Secretary General Hossein Nasrallah has warned the United States and its allies against creating chaos in Lebanon. He made the remarks while he was addressing people during a memorial ceremony for 3 Hezbollah prominent leaders. Maram Saleh reports from Beirut.
On Thursday, Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah warned the United States and its allies that its attempts to stir chaos in the country will not be fruitful.
I'll tell the U.S. if you create chaos in Lebanon, then you will witness chaos in the entire region. If you target our people with your conspiracies, then we will use our power and arms to make you feel pain, even if this means war against your beloved Israel.
The leader of the resistance group also said that the 2019 protests in Lebanon were merely part of a U.S. ploy, which took advantage of weaknesses in the country as part of a new strategy after the failure of direct military invasions.
Lebanon has, from the year 2019, been the target of a new U.S. plot. First, it's a plot to eradicate the achievements and the victories of the resistance and its martyrs. And second, it's a plot to take Lebanon back to being under the hegemony of the U.S., which wants to impose its conditions on the country's domestic affairs and its conditions on relations with the enemy.
Nasrallah, who addressed people during the memorial ceremony of three of Hezbollah's martyred leaders, also emphasized that supporters of the resistance group who are suffering from economic crisis will continue to support the group. Observers believe that all stalemates in Lebanon, whether the inability to elect a president or lack of economic reforms, are all the result of a wave of subtle interference by the U.S.
The U.S. is pressurizing Lebanon economically to impose its conditions and bring to power a president who is loyal to Washington and is not friendly with the resistance, so that it can implement its policies by means of soft power. Having said that, it would not seem that the U.S. has launched a war on Lebanon or the resistance. While it would seem this is an internal Lebanese affair, this is where the threat lies in their plots.
Nasrallah also touched upon the issue of offshore oil and gas exploration, saying Hezbollah will hinder Israel's production of gas from oil fields should procrastination by the companies who have contracts with Lebanon continue.
After assassination of any prominent leader of Hezbollah, the resistance would go through a landmark transformation. Now, in light of what analysts see as a massive U.S. attempt to choke Lebanon politically and economically, the resistance progress is unhindered. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Syrian president has expressed his gratitude to friendly countries, including regional Arab states, for helping Damascus in dealing with last week's deadly earthquake. Bashar Assad said in a televised speech that those countries' assistance enhanced Syria's ability to confront the difficult conditions at critical hours. He added that despite all the assistance, Syria will continue to face social and economic challenges for months and years. He noted that sabotage by terrorist groups and sanctions imposed on the country are further complicating the situation. Following last week's deadly quake, Syria has received about 120 plane loads of assistance from friendly countries, including Iran and some Arab states, which have restored ties with Damascus during the past few years. Also, the earthquake has laid bare the devastating effects of years of Western sanctions against the war-torn country. Syrians are calling for an end to the economic siege as millions of people remain in desperate need of humanitarian assistance. More details following report.
Heads of NGOs in Syria have gathered to loudly voice an urgent need for help. In Damascus, more than 550 NGOs read out a statement before media outlets calling on the U.S. to lift its unilateral economic sanctions on Syria, explaining the years-long siege deprived Syria from its basic needs and equipment needed to rescue those affected by the deadly earthquake.
Today, I apologize to the victims who we heard their voices under the rubble but could not help. Our volunteers were hearing them but couldn't save them because we do not have necessary equipment. 12 years of sanctions left us without required vehicles and rescue equipment. Many people died under the rubble because of those sanctions.
Speakers say the recent ease of U.S. sanctions on Syria to help humanitarian aid reach the country is not effective. That's because banks, companies, and governments around the world are still reluctant to engage with Syria, as they might face legal obstacles in the future. Western states claim that food and medicine is not included in their list of sanctions, but the reality is vastly different.
Sanctions have affected my life, my neighbors, and all Syrian people. We don't have fuel or electricity, and this has raised prices of everything like food and medicine. This is unbearable, especially after the earthquake.
We all here came to say lift economic sanctions. This country cannot stand any more suffering. Even before the earthquake, we were collapsing economically. Those sanctions are only affecting the ordinary people, not the government.
Here, rescue workers are in a battle against time. The death toll keeps rising, and those who could get away from the earthquake are now struggling to survive with a lack of food and shelter. Syrians say it's about time the U.S. and its Western allies end the economic siege that has caused enormous pain and suffering for innocent citizens. They ask for a just and fair world where humanity comes first before all political agendas. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
China has imposed sanctions on two U.S. companies by putting them on its unreliable entities list over arms sales to Taiwan. The new bans came amid heightened tensions between the two countries after the U.S. military shot down what it says was a Chinese spy balloon. The sanctions bar Lockheed Martin and a unit of Raytheon Technologies from engaging in import and export activities related to China. They also ban the companies from further investment in China and bar their senior management from entering the country. The two companies make fighter jets and missiles, which were used in shooting down an alleged Chinese spy balloon. China had warned of countermeasures against relevant U.S. entities and sought to undermine its sovereignty and security. Beijing had already sanctioned the two companies over a $100 million arms deal. And while tensions are running high between Beijing and Washington over the Chinese balloon that entered the U.S. airspace, China has slammed the adoption of a U.S. Congress's resolution condemning Beijing for the incident as a political manipulation. We discuss this in our news review program of Sikalis.
Time now for the news review of this bulletin. China slams as political manipulation the adoption of a resolution by U.S. Congress on the entry of a Chinese balloon into the U.S. airspace earlier this month.
The relevant resolution of the U.S. Congress is in disregard of the basic facts and is purely a political manipulation and a malicious act of hyping up. China is strongly dissatisfied with and firmly opposes this. We strongly urge the U.S. Congress to respect the facts, the guiding principle of international law, and basic norms governing international relations.
The Chinese official urged Washington to immediately stop the, quote, wrong practice of smearing and discrediting China. Wang Wenbin warned Washington against taking moves that could lead to escalation of the situation. Tensions have been running high between Beijing and Washington after a Chinese airship entered U.S. airspace on February 4. The U.S. says the object was a spy balloon, but China says it was an unmanned civilian weather research airship. Beijing has censured Washington for downing the aircraft. The U.S. House of Representatives adopted a resolution on February 9, condemning China for the incident. The Senate also passed a pair of resolutions on Wednesday in that regard. Let's find out what our analysts think. Greg Simmons, author and researcher from Uppsala, Sweden, joins us. We also have Don DeBar, who's an activist and commentator, joining us from Ossining in New York. Okay, gentlemen, welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, if I may. Greg, when you take a look at the resolution, there's obviously one camp that says the U.S. is looking for any reasons to fan the flames when it comes to China and to smear it, basically. Of course, the other camp saying, no, the U.S. is completely within its right. What do you think of it? Which camp are you in?
Well, I mean, it's pretty clear what they're trying to do at the moment is to create a moral panic. And this the focus of this moral panic, the supposed threat, being China. And this is a means to try and draw public attention away from the disasters which that are around the Biden administration and the US in general, and to unite the public, which is very split. So, I mean, this is a move of desperation. And, of course, this is also to do with the changing geopolitical landscape. I mean, the US is a very clearly declining hegemon, and China is the main rising alternative to the US. So it's a threat in many ways, but it's also a distraction.
Thunderbar, what do you think? I mean, at this point, obviously China is not happy about this resolution that was passed. Even prior, it did come out and pretty much said that the U.S. is overreacting to this. Is the U.S. overreacting?
Well, you're talking about the U.S. Congress, first of all. It's important to note that foreign policy is the exclusive domain of the executive branch, in other words, the president. So Congress has no business even doing this. I'll go back to 2018 when President Trump, then President Trump, had scheduled and ended up having a summit with President Putin of the Russian Federation in Helsinki. And there was the possibility that there would be a rollback of sanctions by the U.S. against Russia. And in addition to that, Trump had been negotiating with the DPRK, with North Korea, and there was a possibility of a rollback of sanctions there, all of which implied the possibility of a rollback of sanctions with Iran when Trump got around to that. The Congress, on its own initiative, passed a law basically increasing the sanctions on each of those three nations, and it was passed by a vote of 517, I think, out of a possible 535 votes in the two houses. So, in other words, not only veto-proof, but nearly unanimous. You know, what can you say? First of all, Congress is not, is supposed to be under the Constitution, but it is not the expression of democratic will of the people here. Their polling data going back to the early 90s hovers between 8 and 20% positive, and yet they have a reelection rate of almost 99%. So this is not something that's actually a product of the will of the people here. In addition to that, you have to ask yourself if, you know, genocidal sociopathy can be considered a mental illness, then they have to be considered crazy. Because in the face of avoiding the war that we're now having with Russia, or the possibility of it, they were almost unanimously opposed to any steps in that direction.
Greg Simmons, author and researcher from Uppsala, Sweden, thank you for your comments. Thunderbar, activist and commentator from Austin, New York, thank you. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime's new fascist government has intensified its attacks against Palestinians, which constitutes a war crime. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote in this regard, In a little over a month, the Zionist regime's prime minister has killed Palestinians, demolished their homes, mounted incursions into occupied Palestinian territory, and endeavored to change laws and policies to accelerate the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians from Palestine. This year marks the 75th anniversary of Nakba, the Arabic word for catastrophe. In 1948, the Zionist regime assumed control over more than three-quarters of Palestine. Upwards of 700,000 Palestinians were driven from their homes or forced to flee, and the Zionist regime confiscated much of the land. Now, the Zionist regime's new extremist government, the most anti-Palestinian in the Zionist regime's history, aims to finish the job by incorporating all of the occupied Palestinian territories. Bezalel Smotrich, head of the Zionism Party, is the new Minister of Finance. In 2021, he told Arab members of the Israeli regime Knesset that they were here by mistake because Ben-Gurion didn't finish the job and throw you out in 1948. In his effort to Judaize the occupied West Bank and East al-Quds, the Zionist regime may be trying to cleanse the Palestinians from them. Richard Falk, former UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967, wrote an email to Truth Out. The new Israeli government is the culmination of decades of apartheid subjugation of the Palestinian people in their homeland. In 1967, the Zionist regime attacked Egypt, Jordan, and Syria and seized the Palestinian territories of the West Bank, Gaza, and Al-Quds, as well as the Golan Heights and the Sinai Peninsula. Palestinians call this the Nakba. It ushered in the Zionist regime's prolonged occupation of Palestinian territory, but UN Security Council Resolution 242 passed in 1967 and reaffirmed in 2016, stipulates the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights, PCHR, has documented killings, house demolitions, and incursions by the Zionist regime's occupying forces, IOF, against Palestinians since the beginning of 2023. 43 Palestinians, including 19 civilians, 7 of whom were children, were killed by the IOF. 3 Palestinians were killed by settlers, allegedly in retaliation for shooting and stabbing attacks, and dozens were injured in the occupied West Bank, including East al-Quds. The 4th Geneva Convention forbids the punishment of people in an occupied territory for offenses they didn't personally commit. The Zionist regime's reprisals against families and the community for actions they did not take constitutes collective punishment, which is considered a war crime. In addition, the IOF rendered 33 families homeless, a total of 229 individuals, including 43 women and 108 children. This was the result of IOF demolitions of 34 houses. 6 were forced to demolish their own homes, and 3 were demolished in an exercise of collective punishment. The IOF also demolished 39 other civilian objects, razed other property, and delivered dozens of notices of demolition, cease construction, and evacuation in the West Bank, including East al-Quds, PCHR reported. IOF conducted 1,449 incursions into the West Bank, including occupied East al-Quds, since the beginning of 2023. During these incursions, 638 Palestinians were arrested, including 11 women and 61 children. Moreover, 2022 was the deadliest year for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank in 18 years. The IOF killed at least 146 Palestinians, including 34 children. The new Zionist coalition government has begun the process to prevent the Israeli regime's Supreme Court from overruling legislation passed by the Knesset. There are proposals for the coalition to select judges and replace professional legal advisors with political appointees. The new regime has also withheld nearly $40 million in Palestinian tax revenues and plans to divert that money to victims of Palestinian attacks. Meanwhile, guidelines published by the government call for more construction of Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank, legalization of illegal outposts, and eventual full annexation of the West Bank. The Fourth Geneva Convention prohibits an occupying power from transferring parts of its own civilian population to the territories it occupies. It is illegal for the Zionist regime to directly or tacitly support the building of Jewish settlements on Palestinian land. In 2016, the UN Security Council adopted Resolution 2334, which condemned the fabricated regime of Israel for the establishment of settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, including East al-Quds. It says that the building of settlements has no legal validity and constitutes a flagrant violation under international law. Approximately 650,000 Jewish settlers live in 164 settlements and 116 outposts in the occupied West Bank. Settlers who illegally build settlements on Palestinian territory have been emboldened by the new regime, which includes leaders for the settler movement among its key ministers. Also, the website of Middle East Eye noted Netanyahu's strategy was exposed last week when the Zionist regime's army raided the Palestinian town of Jenin, killing 10 Palestinians, including an elderly woman. That raid, as well as the provocative visit to Al-Aqsa Mosque by the Zionist regime's far-right security minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, triggered the beginning of the collapse of Netanyahu doctrine. In April 2002, the Zionist regime forces stormed the camp, killing more than 50 Palestinians. Around 24 Israeli regime troops were also killed in the operation. Many of Jenin's youth, who are fighting the war today, were babies or were not yet born during the Second Intifada. But the city's history of resistance is engraved into their identity, serving as motivation for their revolutionary actions against the Zionist regime occupation. Located on the periphery of the occupied West Bank, Jenin is geographically very close to Israel, which has facilitated Palestinian operations inside the country. And as the Zionist settlements continue to grow across the West Bank, separating the two regions is proving to be impossible.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends, and condolences to you on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, the seventh infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Here we present you a short but sweet statement from him. The best kind of almsgiving is to help the weak.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle.
Today's lesson, ways of strengthening taqwa through abandoning the material things. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of strengthening the taqwa through abandoning the material things. We know that we are living in the material world, and in this material world, we have some material needs. But the problem occurs where we excessively go towards this material world, or when we consider that everything is this material world. Therefore, it is necessary to do not exceed the limits that are set by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala or the Islamic teachings. Therefore, the moderate way is the best way to be and to have the right way. The moderate way is the best way to follow the Islamic teachings. The moderate way is the best way to have the Islamic life. Therefore, it is necessary to follow the moderate way and do not to exceed the limits in this material world. The problem is we do not believe in Allah the way we should. When we do not believe, when we are under the propaganda of the material world, then our beliefs are not strong enough and they are affected by this material world or the concepts or the things that are being said through this in this material world. The way we study, the educational system that we have, this is all based on this, on the materialism. Therefore, we being a Muslim who believe in God, who believe in soul, who believe in hereafter, who believe that this world is something to work for the hereafter, and the mata of this world, the sustenance of this world is the passing enjoyments, we do not have the firm belief in the context the way we should have. Welcome back.
You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of strengthening the ways of taqwa through abandoning the material things. We said that it is necessary to follow the way in which we can worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Obviously, when we are abandoning the material things, it means that we are not going towards the material things only in order to gain the material, we can say like enjoyments. Why? Because this world is a passing enjoyment, and the things that are provided in this world is for our help, so that we use them as a tool in order to have the best sustenance in hereafter, in order to have the best results in hereafter. Therefore, it is necessary to look at this world as a tool and to use whatever it is provided as the material source in this world as a tool for hereafter. On the other hand, we have the ahadith or the narrations in which it is said, for example, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib has said that haramun ala kulli qalbin mutawallitin bid-dunya. It is haram, forbidden on every single heart to have the love of this dunya, and yaskanahu taqwa. It is haram on the heart in which there is the love of this dunya, the love of this world, that the taqwa should go and reside there. Which means that the taqwa, if we want to gain taqwa, if we want to strengthen the taqwa, we should not have the hubb of dunya, we should not have the love of dunya. Why? Because taqwa does not reside at a place where there is a love for this dunya, where there is a love for this material world, where a person can think that he can just live in this world and this world is the final destination. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
The stories of the revolution.
Part 2.
Tehran, Behisht Zahra Cemetery, January 2014. Each and every alley, street, and place has its own tale. Many of these tales sank into oblivion. Others are more important and remain in our minds, but the point is that people mark history with different kinds of tales. People leave their trace behind in history with their own good and bad conduct, so that there is always a tale to read and learn from. This history can have important or trivial parts, but it is the same history that is fundamental in creating important tales. Thank you. The former Shah of Iran noticed that demonstrations increased in the last days of his rule, but he didn't take the news seriously in the months before the collapse of his regime. He always thought that he could find a way to stabilize the situation. But in the last days of his reign, he had lost his hope due to a massive wave of demonstrations. Paris, January 1979, Nefal le Chateau. When Imam Khomeini was in Najaf, people received his reports and messages late. But everything changed when he came to Paris. France was the center of news agencies and had famous reporters, and every message of the Imam was transmitted to Iran quickly.
Khomeini was now in easy reach of the world's media.
Tehran, 1979, January 16th. The Shah appoints his last prime minister and leaves Iran. Then Shapur Bakhtiar had to face the massive waves of revolutionaries. The situation in the country was chaotic, and no one thought that Imam Khomeini would return to Iran in a few months. But in this situation, the news about Imam Khomeini's imminent return to Iran was published in the first days of February. Shapur Bakhtiar was confused and was all of a duda. At first, he tried to take this opportunity from the Iranian people by besieging the airport. In the meantime, the pioneers of Iran's Islamic Revolution were getting everything set for the return of Imam Khomeini. Mr. Beheshti, Mr. Bahonar, Mr. Rajai, and other people were busy organizing the situation, and each of these people helped the Islamic Revolution in some way. Religious shopkeepers built Refah School, and it was the headquarters of the revolution leadership. As the date of Imam Khomeini's arrival to Iran approached, the activities in the school increased. Each class became an office, and each person had a responsibility. To be brief, this school has many stories from the first days of Imam Khomeini's return. February 1, 1979. On February 1st, 1979, people were getting ready to hold the world's greatest welcoming ceremony in Tehran. Every person did something like washing and cleaning the streets and many other tasks. Organizing that crowd in secret and away from the eyes of the Shah's agents was a great and strange task, but in the meantime, there's a small story that has not been mentioned. It was the last day of practice. We were in harmony. After about 4 hours of practicing in the cold weather, our noses were red. In this 1 week of practice, some of us caught a cold, and so did I. I also had a fever. But I was also trying to show myself cheerful. I was afraid of being removed from the group. After the practice, Mr. Rajai said, "We have to be in front of the airport at 6 a.m. tomorrow." we decided to go together with some of my friends. The sun had not risen yet, but the streets were full of people. We reached the airport with many problems. The airport was very crowded. The door of the hall was closed. Many people were waiting outside the airport for Imam Khomeini's arrival. Mr. Raghib, the group manager, found me in that crowd. It was as if he was looking for the group members. He gave me an envelope and said, "These are the entrance cards of the members of the choir, and we cannot enter the airport without these cards. Hold it until I can find other members of our group." I held the envelope and stood there. Little by little, I saw other members of the group. But there were countless people, and it was difficult to breathe. It was so crowded. I was getting crushed. People pressed me so much, and I lost the envelope. Those who had the entrance cards went to the hall when they opened the door. There were a few people then. I was looking for the envelope, but I could not find it. While I didn't dare, my friend found Mr. Raghibzadeh and told him the problem. I was crying. I was afraid that I would be removed from the group for losing the envelope. Because of losing the cards, people had to leave the hall and do physical inspection again. 2 hours later, we finally entered the hall. I heaved a sigh of relief. We stood in line and waited. Everyone was chattering that the plane took off a few hours ago and would land at the airport very soon. I was anxious. The plane landed at the airport. Some people cried tears of joy. It took an hour for Imam Khomeini to enter the airport hall. Imam Khomeini was sitting and we were preparing ourselves. The hall was full of noise. One of my group mates, Hamid Yeghaneh, shouted, "Khomeini, a Imam." Everyone in the airport hall went silent and looked at us. The song began. Imam Khomeini told Bakhtiar the bitter truth. Then Bakhtiar was sure that he could not confront that huge revolution and cope with it. In the last days of his tenure as prime minister, he inevitably asked the army commanders for help. He had reached the position with the slogan of fundamental changes and claimed that he intended to eliminate the influence of those around the Shah in the government and establish democracy in the country. But it did not take long for Bakhtiar to ask for help from the same people. High-ranking army commanders were sore at Bakhtiar because of his background. "I am the legal prime minister of this country." It was what Bakhtiar claimed, but even the close circle of the Shah did not take Bakhtiar's words seriously, let alone the revolutionaries. Although the army commanders were ordered to support Bakhtiar and his government after the departure of the Shah, but they blamed him for the Shah's leaving and the return of Imam Khomeini, so they did not actually follow Bakhtiar's orders. Bakhtiar did not surrender, and in response to one of his opposing army officers said, "This gentleman, General Gharib Baghi, who was the commander of the joint staff, seems more suitable for the banquet hall than the battlefront." There was a dispute between Bakhtiar and the army commanders. The army commanders thought of their usual solution, a military coup. When they realized that the government could no longer handle the situation, they had the military coup option in their minds. They only wanted to bring the Shah back to Iran, but these army commanders, like their prime minister, were very naive. Meanwhile, a small incident changed everything. On February 6th, a number of Homa Faran officers in the Shah's Iranian Air Force went to Mr. Taleghani's home to meet him. Mr. Taleghani said that everyone knew that the army supported Imam Khomeini and the revolution, but he said that we had to be sure that the army forces could meet Imam Khomeini in military uniforms. By this, people's trust could increase and Bakhtiar's lies will have been exposed. Murtaza and Akbar were thinking. Mr. Nurshahi, the chief of the forces, was with us. But if someone found out about our meeting with Ayatollah Taleghani and reported it, we would face many hardships. The chief of forces arranged the meeting and we went out. At that time, we had to find a solution. We only trusted about 40 people who were revolutionaries. The next day, we gathered in the garrison and the situation was chaotic. The situation was in turmoil. Every day, the personnel came to the garrison, but they were confused and did not know what to do. The situation in the army was a mess, but not everyone could be trusted. Each of us came up with an opinion, and suddenly Murtaza said, "I have an idea that if I tell you, you won't let me carry it out, so I will do it myself, and you take care of me." We were looking at Murtaza with surprise when he suddenly and angrily started shouting. Everyone was silent and looking at us. He shouted and insulted Imam Khomeini, the people, and the revolution. We were staring open-mouthed at him when we realized that all of the soldiers were around us. We just found out his intention when some soldiers started to attack him. All the military unit members were beating Murtaza. We were confused. We were happy that other members of the military unit were with us, but on the other hand, Murtaza was really losing his life. Akbar took the whistle of the chief and went on my shoulders. Finally, we could calm them down and explain to them Murtaza's intention. Everyone was looking at Murtaza that was covered in blood. We decided to leave the garrison and meet each other the day after at the Alavi school. The garrison was soon empty. At 8 in the morning on the 8th of February, around 700 Homa Faran officers in the Shah's Iranian Air Force entered the Alavi school in their own clothes and later changed their clothes in the classes. We were waiting in the hall when Imam Khomeini came in. Air Force of Iran were the first ones who pledged and saluted Imam Khomeini. The publication of the photo of the Homa Faran pledge with Imam Khomeini surprised the army commander so much that they quickly denied the news of this incident and said, "This photo is fake." When Bazargan formed the interim government, everyone tried to persuade Bakhtiar to resign and stop the bloodshed. But Bakhtiar did not accept to resign and until the last day considered himself as the prime minister in this troubled government. There were a few days left for the victory of the Islamic Revolution when the army commanders, who were looking for a coup since a few days ago, were secretly sending troops to Tehran from the garrisons in distant cities, and revolutionaries hadn't yet realized this. The Iranian people did great work in the few days left before the victory of the Islamic Revolution. It was then when great moments and tales were created. The last 2 days before the victory of the Islamic Revolution are considered to be the best and most difficult days during that time.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The killing of black Americans or African Americans by US police has been highlighted by US media in recent years. These killings have become so normal that it seems Americans have accepted it because there is no police accountability in the United States. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered the story and tells us more. A new data analysis reveals US law enforcement killed at least 1,176 people in 2022, making it the deadliest year on record for police violence in the United States since experts first started tracking the killings. According to Mapping Police Violence, police across the country killed an average of more than 3 people a day, or nearly 100 people every month last year. The non-profit research group maintains a database of reported deaths at the hands of law enforcement, including people fatally shot by police, beaten or restrained or tasered. In 2021, police officers killed 1,145 people. 1,152 were killed in 2020. 1,097 individuals were killed by US law enforcement in 2019. 1,140 were killed in 2018. And 1,089 were killed in 2017. The earliest data goes back to 2013, when advocates began counting these fatal incidents. A database run by the Washington Post, which tracks fatal shootings by police officers, also shows 2022 as a year with record killings. The data release comes 2 years after the murder of George Floyd sparked national uprising calling for racial justice, police accountability, and reductions in funding and size of police forces throughout the United States. Despite the international attention and some local efforts to curb police brutality, there has been an intensifying backlash to criminal justice reform, and the overall number of killings has remained alarmingly high. Bianca Austin, the aunt of Breonna Taylor, whose March 2020 killing in Kentucky sparked mass protests throughout the United States, said, "It just never stops. There was a movement and uproar across the globe, and we're still having more killings. What are we doing wrong? It's so disheartening." While the numbers have crept up, the circumstances that precede the killings have remained consistent. In 2022, 132 killings, or 11% of the total, were cases in which no offence was alleged. 104 cases, or 9% of the total, were mental health or welfare checks. 98 cases, or 8% of the total, involved traffic violations.